the second part of the interview on November the 21st with General Marshall. I know it's the Joint Staff Studies Committee. That's what it is, Joint Staff Studies Committee.
As to this question one, in October 43, which one of these views was nearest to your own? As nearly as I can recall, I think the Army view, though I'm not to call positive on that subject. I must say that during phases here, I thought that it was not possible in such a broad theater to plan so far in advance. It's so much dependent on the success of certain of the local operations as to whether they should be continued, or whether we should continue along that course.
However, as you said about the War Department, you were quite willing for them to consider various possibilities.
Oh yes, any possibility.
I mean the State Department.
I didn't want to put any restriction in their thinking at all. Question two is to the pressing of procedure. I have no particular comment to make except that I thought if you let the thing drift, as it were, why, you never get anywhere. And the trouble is inherent in all these things is everybody wanted things that we couldn't give them. And they were, you had to press them to accomplish the thing without all of the means that might later become available. Earlier in our discussions, there was a question about what I thought about Montgomery. Montgomery, when he got into the fight, was, I think, excellent. But on the other hand, if we'd had about three commanders like Montgomery, we'd never made any fights because they never could have settled who was going to get everything to do it. Montgomery required, he might say, in favor of his troops, forces and supplies and everything in such number. But as a matter of fact, we couldn't have conducted this these campaigns if everybody had followed his procedure, because there just wasn't enough to go around. And you'd have to make complete abandonment of things in the theaters, like in the Pacific, or in order to comply. The Pacific, for instance, at the start got very, very little, and up in the Philippines, MacArthur got nothing, and out in Australia there was very little set out there for quite a long time. The Marines went into Guadalcanal on my urging, in a way, because if we lost that field there, we were pushed way to the south in trying to move our troops into the Australia to turn them north. And so we went ahead and made it with what we had, which was almost entirely Marine. Later on in that fight, we wanted to put in Army divisions, and we couldn't manage the thing with the admiral in command there on that island off Australia. And he had such a backup of tonnage that I sent Arnold from Washington out to see what he had and to count the ships. And I dimly recall now, it was something like 82 ships standing idle in that harbor there. Well, of course, we couldn't afford at that time, any time as a matter of fact, but certainly not at that time, any use of tonnage on any such line as that. But we couldn't get the army in. When they did go up there, the Marines thought they'd been very long in coming. But, Collins and those fellows wanted to get up there, but they couldn't. Patch and Collins and that crowd are all fighters and had very good divisions, very good divisions. Later on, they put a division in there that was not at all so good. And they made a mess of it up on near Russell Island or someplace like that. And it made it very difficult for me because it was a National Guard division.
I know. Isn't that the one that Howling Mad Smith got so mad about? It was also commanded by Smith.
No, it was the 27th.
Yeah. Now, which was the one that General Harding had, and he was finally relieved?
I've forgotten.
He'd been an old friend of yours, hadn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, he was a very young officer, as far as I was concerned, but I was very fond of him, and still am. But I had nothing to do whatever with his promotion. As a matter of fact, when McNair made him a major general and gave him this division, he came in to call on me. He'd been sent for by McNair, and he came in to call on me. And I said, Harding, this is going to be your downfall. McNair has explained to you the state of this division. And he said, yes, he had. Well, I said, this is going to be your downfall. You're going to have many friends, and you're going to get relief in command. And that's exactly what happened.
That happened in that the 90th Division, I think, that went to Europe, and you remember had three. I was told that the commander liked everybody. Everybody liked him.
Reminds me of Mrs. Marshall was called upon to make a speech to a lot of women, and she hadn't done anything like that, and she didn't want to do it. And I said, well, I think you've got to do something like that, and this is a pretty appropriate occasion. When she said, what will I talk about? Well, I said, you have a very happy way of landing on the things that are of interest. But I'll say one thing, you might exploit this, that mothers should look with care in the training period to a popular commander. The chances are 9 out of 10, he's going to get licked. And she made a very good speech on the subject and got these mothers much concerned about it, which is pretty much true. The most famous case is that field out in the Philippines that the Japanese first shot down the planes on. Stotzenberg. Dan Stotzenberg, where the airfield is. He was so desperately unpopular with his Nebraska regiment that the legislature was considering in debate an action, a resolution demanding of the War Department his relief. Just then the war broke out on February the 4th, 99. And by the evening of the third day, he was the most popular commander in the thing, and they just swore by him. And then he was killed.
Whoa.
Just about the time they got up to Camp Stotzenberg, and the place was named after him. But they were just trying to get the legislature by a resolution to demand of the War Department that he be relieved. And when the war started, and then they felt the discipline, and they felt the command and control, and they were just crazy about Stotzenberg. Really very dramatic.
It certainly is.
Now here we got Buccaneer. Question two. There was a great deal of argument about Buccaneer. And I'm sorry to admit that I don't remember the various courses of it at this time. I know the British were not in favor of it. Sorry, I can't give a clean-cut reaction to that.
Well, first and last, there were about 12 different operations out there that were planned. I remember Lord Portal, when I talked to him in 46, said it may be just a short time, but too many things were taken up. And he'd say, if you brief me, I'll tell you a little something about it, but I can't remember the details.
I am so dim on my recollection about Buccaneer that I can't remember. And I can't answer the fourth question. So much of these things were psychological rather than plain logical.
But you don't recall whether or not that you felt that Mr. Roosevelt was just arbitrarily overriding the
no,
chief of staff at that time.
No, but as a matter of fact, in a sense he was overriding us on the China policy. The only thing was that I didn't make it a battle. There was no point to it. He was intent on doing these things with China, and was favorable to the Generalissimo because Chenault was working on him direct, and this Admiral Madame's brother, who's the president of the executive one and the ambassador over here, was dealing with the president direct. And the president's reactions were so influenced from the outside that when Wilkie went out there, Alsop and those fellows got a hold of Wilkie, and of course, I think Stilwell made nothing of the occasion at all, but just allowed them to turn their guns on him. All these things came to the president, you see, and he was determined about China against British opposition because they didn't rank China as anything, as having any strength or force at all. You might say any importance to the future settlement of things. The president was so intent about it that as far as the chiefs of staff were concerned, or more particularly so far as I was concerned, I didn't perpetuate the battle. I accepted the best of it. And as I told Sherwood or whatever it is, wrote that book, don't question me on the China thing, because I just stepped back and let nature, in a sense, take its course. Except that I wanted Stilwell to resign his command and let me give him another command.
And it would have been better for him if he had, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. Because the trouble was, with all his ability, he dissipated that ability by his open criticism of the Generalissimo and allowing his staff to do the same thing, which is the worst thing you can do. One of them got back to me, started to tell me. I said, I don't want to hear the words you have to say. You've already done all the harm you possibly can do. Don't try to set up any more back here. He was a fellow I'd known very well, and he was so shocked at my reaction. Well, he says, you don't favor this or something. And I said, it isn't a question of favor. I don't approve at all of what you personally have done. And I wouldn't have you on my staff. Of course, staff cliques and staff talks and all play a great part in all these things. But if you permit them to an open development and feed them grist for their meal, why, you've got an awful mess on your hands. And that is the greatest mistake Stillwell did, aside from his open criticism of the journalists for allowing his staff to mill around with all these things.
I know
particularly critical there, because he was a splendid fighting man, Given Stillwell a fine corps, and I think a fine army, but certainly a fine corps, he would have put up a magnificent performance. He knew the game, he was courageous to the limit, and he was adventurous, and yet he was calculating, and it's too bad that he had to be laboring with this kind of a semi-diplomatic situation and being played off by a superb performer at the game, Chennault. Just imagine a line staff officer in the position that Alsop was to go to India and talk to the Indian Army adversely to Stillwell and everything, and nothing done about it at all. Now there I entered into it, and I made a recommendation to the President. And then I discovered, doggone it, that he followed his usual custom. He didn't file that, he sent it back over. So it isn't in the record of the White House. He did that time and again.
I see.
He wouldn't take the unfavorable thing and file it. Mm-hmm. He'd send it back to you so it would be on your side of the fence.
Well, he had, for some reason, the Alsops are Republicans, and their father was a strong Republican, but they got very close to the President before the war.
Very close.
As youngsters. And he used to feed them stuff before Alsop was commissioned. He fed them information he wanted in the papers.
I see. What was the champion plan?
It's something around Mandalay, but not all the way up to it. It was one of those small operations. Yeah, it was the land part of Buccaneer, really.
I give a quotation here. Whose quotation is it?
Stillwell's, from his book, his diary.
He's saying that.
Saying that you said it.
That I said it. SEAC.
It's Southeast Asia Command. That's Mountbatten's command.
Question one, I think it is, but I'm not entirely clear in my recollections. See, I can't answer question two.
He obviously did not, that quotation is obviously not something he wrote down while you were talking. It's his recollection of what you said. And that's a very dangerous thing for a historian to do, is to quote that kind of a quotation as if it's precise. But what I'm really wondering was whether that more or less represented your point of view there.
Tarzan.
That's operations in North Burma.
What did it go towards?
Towards the China frontier. No, I'm wrong. It's just the opposite. It was an attempt to take those troops from Yunnan and push into Burma from the southwestern Chinese area. Still had a force, but he wanted to get some Chinese in there to help him. That $1 billion gold loan really raised trouble. That Morgenthau got in on that.
Chapter 16, question 1. I don't know how to answer that.
You didn't get in on any of that business about the loan to China, did you? That was handled entirely by the president.
I don't recall about that.
Well, had you told Stillwell to send a mission along with Mountbatten's, or...
I suppose I did. I don't recall that. He came over himself once there, but I don't think that is the time.
No. Mountbatten, though, got very angry about him sending a mission. He said he shouldn't have. And I believe you said, well, he was an American commander as well as being under Mountbatten.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that setup of Stillwell was wholly illogical. He was serving about three masters and being undercut by his commander-in-chief, the president.
You couldn't have worked out a much worse command situation,
oh,
could you?
Oh, it was terrible. Snow was just stirring it up, you know, all over the place. Question three, I'm not certain, but I believe it was generally accepted. Question four is accepting the offer of the British forces for use in the Pacific. I had no particular reaction. King was very intent.
He didn't want them, did he?
He didn't want them because they thought we'd have supplies. He made it quite embarrassing.
The president just went over his head there, didn't he?
Yes, I think so. Question five, do you feel that the MacArthur supporters can be fairly charge you with failing to support him? I supported him through thick and thin on most of the questions. I don't recall this particular phase of the thing. But he had a great many prejudices, intense feelings. All of this was arrangeable if the two commanders wanted to get together. But their approaches, particularly on MacArthur's side, were so filled with deep prejudice that it was very hard to go about it, to get about it. I always felt that who was the other admiral?
Nimitz?
No. He wasn't the other admiral. Who was the fighting admiral out there?
Halsey.
Huh?
Halsey?
I always felt that if Halsey could have been given a more leading role, that he could have gotten along with General MacArthur. Because he very much wanted to. And even the simple procedure taking the tie off the shirt was a move to produce general unanimity. Nimitz himself is not a quarrelsome man, but I think his staff was very much embittered because they were being criticized continuously by MacArthur's outfit.
But was that due entirely to the general's personality, that he just wanted to run things? And
who?
MacArthur.
Yes, he wanted to run things.
And he felt that he was, that his...
He just took a very decided stand on anything like that that affected his command. There were no concessions on his part whatsoever. Well, the war picked anything like that's made up of concessions and adjustable one way or the other. But the Nimitz's staff had become so feeling so bitter towards General MacArthur, and MacArthur's staff so bitterly towards Nimitz, that it was almost impossible to get them together on anything. They'd come in to see me, and I could find some of them, notably desirous of reaching adjustments, but the suspicion was just profound.
He thought they were trying to take away some of his glory, and vice versa.
Looking towards the future all the time. The personal thing was getting into it deeply. The personal thing more on MacArthur's side than the naval thing on the Nimitz's side.
Well, did they feel you were handing over the victories to the Navy all the time?
Who?
You, personally.
Did who feel?
Did MacArthur's people feel that you were...
Well, apparently they do now, but apparently they didn't then.
Because I see no evidence of it. It seems to me that you were continuing.
I was fighting his battle from the start to the finish. As I say, I even wrote his Medal of Honor decoration and all those things. And saw that he was promoted and given these ranks when it was actually opposed by Mr. Simpson and the President. But particularly Jack McCloy, got him to command in the end in Japan over the tremendous objections of the Navy. Because we got no help from his side at all, because it was all so acid that it wasn't helpful at all to an adjustment or a decision. But we just had to battle at that. But Jack McCloy really played the leading part, but he and I led this fight to see that the Army retained command with MacArthur in the lead.
Well, the British didn't want him particularly either, did they?
No, I don't know about that. I don't know whether they had an expression in regard to that particular thing or not. I shouldn't have said that. I felt the way the forces were deployed out there, they could go right ahead, but there were adjustments to be made. I remember they sent a very good naval force to help MacArthur at Hollandia, and then there was no use for it there. There's much talk about that. But there was one time when they were coming across to help. The distance was very great. They probably couldn't go back and forth with the facility, but they could have mastered most of those difficulties if there'd been a desire to do so. I found that Halsey, when he was on that island to the, what was the last island he went to? Up above the Guadalcanal, before you get to that place we never did take, we bypassed.
Rabaul?
Before you get to Rabaul.
Oh, there's New Britain and New...
New Britain's way to the west.
Yeah, way to the west there. I can't remember.
It's a big island there. They fought on the fringe for quite a while.
In New Guinea?
No, New Guinea. That's to the west.
Yeah.
This is to the east, the southeast.
I can't think what it is.
Great big island. Halsey was worrying very much about MacArthur's reaction, where Halsey was to do something, and his current situation got in the way of it. And he felt that MacArthur would feel very badly about it. But he was concerned about getting the thing harmonized, which appealed to me.
Well, Kincaid apparently didn't get in on that like Halsey did.
Well, he was very quiet. Kincaid took orders. As a result of that, though, he played a brilliant part. A brilliant part in that battle in the Philippines. He's hardly mentioned. His destruction of that southern fleet coming up.
Yes.
He had the antiquated force. And it was a beautiful job. And almost nothing is said about it. But in all these things, he was very close-mouthed throughout. And for that reason, got along.
Apparently, Spruance had some trouble, too.
I don't know about that. You speak about MacArthur. There's speak about MacArthur holding the service troop. Question of great importance. I wonder if it is not this. From the War Department, then, we ran into a very difficult situation. We had, I think, quite naturally assumed that the fighting forces, particularly of the air, in that theater, north of Australia, New Guinea, and thereabouts, would tire out long before the fellows on the ground. Now, I sent a general officer out there to look into certain things for me. I'll mention the other matters later. But I wanted him to look around, see things that were not being reported, and tell me, not just what they were yelling about. And he came back with a very important observation, which bears on this business of reaction of MacArthur's towards the ground troops, the support troops, I guess you call them. Contrary to our expectation, the wearing out process was occurring more rapidly with this ground forces of the Air Corps than of the fighting forces, for the reason that they had to work on the plains at night, and they couldn't have any mosquito bar protection, and they'd become so full of adrenaline that for a while the pilots objected to using the planes because these fellows were so dopey, they weren't certain they were putting the cotter pins in and things of that sort, and the men on the ground were just dopey with this terrible doses of adrenaline they had to take because under electric lights they're working all night with the mosquitoes just eating them up. And it became quite evident that they would have to be relieved first or sent back somewhere free of the insect pest to recuperate. And they all had a form of malaria or overdose of adrenaline, one of the two. Now, we hadn't anticipated that at all and just reversed things for us in our training of replacements back in the United States. And incidentally, these young pilots were outnumbered badly for a long time by the Japanese Zero planes. And these young pilots were complaining about the planes they had, which were heavier than the Zero planes, and they were being shot down by the Japanese. And they were running on an exhausted basis. And that was the principal thing I sent this general out to find out. I said, I want you to talk to the individual pilots and a number of them. First thing you can tell them is if there's anything they'd like done to their planes, such as trimming them of all the armor and everything on the plane, I will have it done. Anything they require about that plane that can be done, it will be done. All they have to do is tell you. And I want you to tell it from me to them. And we had stripped the plane over here to get the difference in weight. But of course that took off all the armor. Well, so he had the data of what could be done. And he came back, he was much amused because they were so intent on this thing, they went into it all and told them they could have it. And then it meant the removal of all this armor and all. And then they turned it down. They didn't want to do it. Well, their reclamer boiled down to one thing. They wanted girls. But we were completely reversed on the necessities of the ground in view of the working at night and the mosquito menace. In order to get at that affair out there, which at Guadalcanal and other places has become very critical, I sent out a great expert on the malaria. And I had to arm him with very careful instructions in order to get him to do anything. And I had a preliminary concentration of equipment, which we guessed would be needed, made in California at the port, because we couldn't maintain the thing. For instance, the 1st Marine Division was out of action for over a year, for 13 months. Well, we couldn't maintain an army out there with the withdrawals on such a length of that, but they were so loaded up with mosquito malaria thing that they were down there, and I think it was in New Zealand, or I believe it was 13 months. And we couldn't possibly supply troops at that rate. So this fellow found out that they didn't have this mosquito protection for the messes or this or that or the other. And of course, the decision as to what was to be shipped was left to the department commander. He notified the shore, notified the United States, what he wanted. Well, his people, who were back at his headquarters and undoubtedly sitting in mosquito-protected places, were demanding a great many things, but not netting, not screening, nothing of that sort. So we just had to put it on without their order, override a portion of the tonnage, and send that out. And this fellow indicated where it must be used. And we gave instructions that it must be used in that way. But we had to control the shipping, because on that side, they were after the combat necessities, and we were trying to cut down the malaria spread.
That's an interesting thing that I hadn't thought about. The fact, of course, this man has protection, this one man, and yet he can affect the welfare of great numbers of people.
Oh, my Lord, yes.
That's why you had to have this constant group of people who weren't under those conditions, checking on them.
I just have to send them around the world all the time.
They weren't always very popularly received, were they?
Well, yes, more than you would think they'd be disliked, because they got things for these fellows.
Oh, yeah.
And I would tell them always, if you can find anything that they want that they haven't got that we've got,
we'll get it.
Give them that. Let them know you're giving them that. Well, they have very specific instructions to that. Because I did that all over the United States. I always had something I could give a division. And if they didn't ask for it, I'd say, how about such and such? Well, we haven't got a damn thing. Well, do you want it? Yes. Well, I'd write the telegram right on the wing of the plane and send it right off. I remember telling those fellows specifically about that. But I sent word to these pilots, I couldn't supply the girls. I could be sympathetic, but I couldn't supply them.
But you would not have considered tearing up any the combat unit there at the last, would you? To supply, to give him. I say you would never consider tearing up a combat division.
No,
I
was confronted once with the necessity for tearing up, I think it was two, when I took those fellows out of college.
Oh, yes.
I was determined to get an army at full strength. And kept at that strength for all the fighting. That was the important thing to me, not the number of divisions at all. Well, I was quite right about that. It made all the difference. It was like the fighters going, pilots and all, flying out of England. All. We had to have replacements in such a way that the mess table was always full. If they failed to come in, the other man had to take their place. Just to sit down and find half the table empty. It was a very depressing morale factor. And those things, those psychological reactions, have got to be foreseen. Now, I remember when we discovered the Japanese had retreated from that island, I've even forgotten the name of the island, in the Aleutians, which meant that nobody else was left because we defeated them on the tip of the Aleutians. And now, in having this final expedition to throw them out of this particular island, they had retreated from that before our attack struck. I sent for Summerall right away, the minute we heard that, the same day. And I said, now, you've got to get a couple of transports right away, immediate sailing, up to the Aleutians or Alaska, wherever these men will come into, and start the movement of troops from that command. You can't move so many, of course, as we can eventually withdraw. But the movement was to be started, and you ought to have two transports in it instantly. Well, he said, I haven't got any transport there. Oh, every one is scheduled for these other operations, and I just can't do it. Well, I said, Silly, you've got to do it. I mean,
Summerall,
you've got to do that. Because if you don't do that in standard, there's going to be set up the most tremendous demand from these men to get out of the Aleutians and out of Alaska, and it's going to come with an impact that will get political very, very quickly. And he said, I don't know where in the world I'm going to get them. Well, I said, I certainly don't, but get them, by God, get them, and get them up there right away. If you could put them there tomorrow, I'd say get them there tomorrow. Well, of course, it took some time to move the transport up, even if it was difficult to get. Within 3 days, the impact on that whole command was the fighting was over. They'd put up with terrific conditions there in the Aleutians. Now they wanted to come home, and they wanted to come home fast, and I had a congressional committee on my hands on the fourth day.
Oh.
And when I got the some of those transports up there, that began to cut it down because the movement had started. That started, that took off the heat. But it couldn't get up there for some days. And some of them couldn't see that. I wanted to get it started instantly. I wanted the orders to be gotten out within 24 hours. But I couldn't beat the punch on it. The instant the fighting was over, the reaction was come home.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to have any of it. They're all going home. And the next thing is the Committee of Congress.
Well, you'd run into that in the First War, too.
Oh, of course, it's just tremendous there. The trouble there was, you see, all the men that went home were sore about it because they'd just gotten over and they wanted to see France.
Yeah.
And the men that were up doing the fighting couldn't get back to the ports to get home. So General Pershing was up against it in every way. They didn't look at it that way. That's just the way it was, and they did it. And, of course, they had a tremendous attack on General Pershing and his command. He was very unpopular, you know, when he came home. People have forgotten that in the long years that have elapsed. And I knew this was going to happen right off. That is the reason I took fellows from the front lines at the end of the war, or the end of the German war, and had them moved out of a plane and brought right into the United States. I was trying to offset that same reaction. The only trouble was there, out of a beautifully worked out plan, it was a beauty. Everything went wrong. As you said, maybe you thought didn't want peace right away. We had to take it any way we could get it, but
yes.
It was just the devil. Question 7. I was never satisfied as to the business for the combat men, but that was excusable then, because before we could get anything working well, a desperate battle developed, which everybody had to get into.
That finished them. That's all the questions I brought down here with me.
Well, not that I want to get rid of you, but yeah. I'm sort of glad.
Well,
I'm getting a little tired.
That's the one thing I don't want to do, and I wish you'd always let me know. Because some days you just tire more quickly than others.
Well, I don't feel it really until afterwards.
Good.
And I don't know what happened to me yesterday. I went out for a long walk after you left. And right from the start, I was having difficulties. And I was completely all in when I got back. And you exactly couldn't call it exhausting, but my...